Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Munro Dodd. In our lives, the image of the FBI has alternated between heroic and demonic. From the 1930s on, movies and TV shows depicted the heroic side. Locally, we're familiar with how the FBI in its G-man role pursued Midwestern bad guys, from the perpetrators of the Union Station massacre to the bosses of organized crime. Later in the 20th century, congressional investigations and reporters unearthed another side, one less heroic. It has to do with the agency's primary focus since its inception: enemies of the government, foreign and domestic. The FBI's director for nearly half a century, J. Edgar Hoover, made a career of rooting out spies, saboteurs, and subversives, and didn't let the Constitution stand in his way. Our guest today, Tim Weiner, has written a book about the FBI's and Hoover's quest to stamp out subversives, or its obsession to do so. In his work for the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer, Tim has covered the Pentagon and the CIA and examined terrorism in Africa and Asia. Along the way, he won a Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is Enemies, A History of the FBI. Tim Weiner joins us today from NPR Studios in New York. Tim, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Hi, Munro.
The reputation of J. Edgar Hoover has been severely tarnished, but you write that he was less a monster than a Machiavelli. Machiavelli was good at political preservation, and Hoover preserved his own position for half a century while watching his country's enemies and his own. How was he less a monster than a Machiavelli?
Well, we know Hoover as a caricature. For example, from the recent movie, J. Edgar, as, you know, a tyrant in a tutu or, you know, some kind of cross-dressing crank. Well, none of that is true and none of that really matters. In the story of J. Edgar Hoover, he was one of the two or three most important figures in the government of the United States in the 20th century. He served, as you said, for 48 years as the head of the FBI until his death in 1972. And we still live in his shadow. He cast a long, long shadow, because this is the man that invented the modern surveillance state. This is the guy who invented the fingerprint file. This is the guy who invented the use in this country of wiretapping, bugging, and breaking and entering as a means of intelligence gathering.
And all of
against
this,
the enemies of the United States.
And all of this without a charter.
Well, that's right. The FBI never had a charter, and it still doesn't, because its birth was, shall we say, illegitimate.
Teddy Roosevelt started it, didn't he? And he tried to get Congress to approve it and failed?
That's right, Munro. Teddy Roosevelt was the kind of president who didn't let things like the law and the Constitution stand in his way. I mean, remember, this is the guy who built the Panama Canal without asking the Panamanians.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted a federal police force. This is back now at the beginning of the 20th century, because he wanted to be able to control two forces in the United States. And one was anarchy. Teddy Roosevelt got to be president because an anarchist shot President McKinley
mm-hmm.
in 1901, and T.R. was the vice president. And he also wanted to control corruption in Congress. Well, Congress didn't want a federal police force looking over its shoulder, and Congress was crooked as the day was long back then. And so they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't approve it. And so T.R. and his attorney general, whose name was Bonaparte, and he was actually a grandnephew of the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, a real blue blood, just went behind Congress's back and formed the FBI, snuck a little sentence into a budget bill, got some money, and ginned it up.
So in a way, it's not a surprise that the FBI over the decades has pushed the limits of the Constitution. After all, its creators, the presidents, have done the same thing.
That's right. I mean, you have to see the powers of the FBI as a secret intelligence service, conducting buggings and break-ins and wiretapping and espionage and eavesdropping as a function of the president's power. And President Franklin D. Roosevelt gave Hoover that power when the Supreme Court, for example, outlawed wiretapping at the end of the 1930s. FDR wrote Hoover a one-page memo that said essentially, screw the Supreme Court. You just keep on doing what you're doing. And Hoover did. He kept that memo at the top of his desk for the rest of his life.
So many presidents along the way, though, as we'll talk about in a minute, not all of them were quite the enabler of J. Edgar Hoover. Even before there was an FBI, in fact, though, in the 19-teens and 20s, Hoover, who was a very young man, he's barely past 21 years old, was fighting terrorism and directing and developing techniques of surveillance. Because in those days, there were not only anarchists, there were, by the time of World War I, foreign agents who actually were trying to sabotage American life. Isn't that true?
That's correct. And there have been, since an anarchist shot President McKinley, there had been going up to and during World War I a number of forces, including anarchists and including, after 1919, communists. Who wanted to overthrow or abolish the government of the United States, and who were blowing up Wall Street. They blew up the Attorney General's house. They were planting bombs and trying to kill American leaders and American institutions. Now, this is a very small group of people, but they had a tremendous impact. And when you look at what they did during and after World War I, you're reminded immediately of Al-Qaeda. They blew things up. There, you could go down to Wall Street here in New York City, where I am today, and you can still see the scars from a huge bomb that went off at the corner of Wall and Broad in a case the FBI never solved. And so Hoover, when he was still 25 years old, as the number three man at the Justice Department, this is before he joined the FBI, got together the biggest manhunt in American history and put more than 6,000, probably closer to 10,000, we'll never know the real number, thousands of people in jail in a huge national dragnet in January 1920. And about 95% of these cases were later thrown out. The forces of anarchy and the forces of the early Communist Party of the United States were very interested in blowing up individuals and institutions that represented American power, and they existed to abolish power itself, just like Al-Qaeda, and they used the same methods.
Tim, your book, Enemies, A History of the FBI, I think presents a really balanced view of all this, because it just in the moment you think that J. Edgar Hoover and his agency are overdoing this, we're reminded that there was at least a reason for the beginning of the overdoing of it. But nevertheless, when Hoover saw a danger, it seems, he would enlarge the danger. Did you think he believed that the danger was worse than it was, or did he, like Machiavelli, just coldly see an opportunity in this menace?
I think both. Hoover believed, to the marrow of his bones, that communism was a force that could destroy the United States. And he really did see Reds under a lot of beds. Now, the problem was that by, the 1950s, the Communist Party of the United States was a completely spent force. But he kept on keeping on. And then in the 60s, he painted people who were, for example, Martin Luther King, the head of the Civil Rights Movement, people who opposed the war in Vietnam, painted them, tarred them with the same brush, and saw them as deep, dark forces of international communism when they were actually Americans, seeking justice under law and seeking an end to a bloody and brutal war.
Hoover took over what was called then the Bureau of Investigation in 1924. And looking back on him, he's had this amazing ability to survive the currents of Washington. But it turns out when FDR was taking office, his candidate for attorney general might well have ousted Hoover back in the early 30s, and then an amazing thing happened.
Yeah, he died of a heart attack in a railroad car headed to Washington with, this was a gentleman in his 70s, and he had a brand new bride in his 20s, and I guess he overdid it. Hoover would have been a minor footnote in American history had this fellow lived. But presidents came and presidents went, but J. Edgar Hoover was always there.
Now, FDR in the 1930s, you write, tried to get Hoover directed toward rooting out German agents in the United States, but he approached that task rather in a blasé manner compared to his feeling about communists. Is that right?
That's right. Before World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt told Hoover, I want you to root out fascists and communists in the United States. Well, there must have been, you know, at the top of its game, there were no more than 80,000 card-carrying communists in the United States. But there were at least 10 times that number of people, including some very prominent people, who supported Hitler, who supported fascism, who wanted the Nazis to win. And they were marching the streets with swastikas and silver shirts. And Hoover wasn't very interested in rooting them out. He wanted to keep the focus on the war on communism, and he did.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Today we're talking about the FBI and its decades of secret intelligence operations. Our guest is Tim Weiner, author of Enemies, A History of the FBI. Tim, his attention had to be dragged, obviously, very quickly toward Germany and then Japan when the hostilities began. And, in fact, on the business of communist infiltration or Soviet infiltration, all of a sudden, in the 1940s, the Soviet Union is our ally. This must have been a great conflict for Hoover.
He was appalled at that fact. And we need to be reminded every now and then that if it hadn't been for Joe Stalin and the Red Army, we would probably all be speaking German today. Not a pleasant prospect. Mm-hmm. But the Hoover's triumph, really, over an American president, Harry Truman, came after World War II. He basically said that President Truman wasn't up to the job of fighting communism, that the Roosevelt and Truman administration had been riddled with communists. And he, along with a couple of senators and congressmen, including a freshman congressman named Richard Nixon, became the leaders of anti-communism in the United States. And after the self-proclaimed leader of this war, Senator Joe McCarthy, did himself in by going after the Army and the CIA. Really, it was J. Edgar Hoover and by then Vice President Richard Nixon who became the generals in the war on communism. And Hoover did some amazing things in the 1950s to destroy not just communism in this country, but international communism.
He is one of the architects, as you put it in the book, of the whole Cold War mentality, the suspicion, perhaps paranoia, fear, whatever you want to call it.
Well, that's right. And by the 1950s, the Communist Party of the United States was a spent force. They had very few members, very few people followed them or followed the Stalinist line. But Hoover did some amazing things. For example, in 1958, he had a guy whose name was Morris Childs, who once had been very prominent in the Communist Party of the United States. And he convinced, and his agents convinced, Childs to work for the FBI. So Childs rejoined the Communist Party of the United States, became their foreign secretary, their number two guy. And he traveled to Moscow and met with all the communist leaders of the world, and he went to Beijing and met with Mao Zedong, and he did this every couple of months for almost 20 years. And this is beginning in the 1950s. The CIA never had a spy like that, but the FBI did, and delivered some pretty deep insights into what the heads of international communism were thinking at the time. And this deeply impressed Nixon, who was then still the vice president. The tragedy of the relationship between Nixon and Hoover is they had been tight as ticks for 25 years. But in the last year of Hoover's life, they broke up. And that had devastating consequences for the FBI and indeed for Richard Nixon.
By that point, J. Edgar Hoover is aging, but he's also not pursuing the forces that Nixon wanted pursued quite as vigorously as Nixon thought he should.
Hoover balked only a few times when presidents told him to execute wiretapping, bugging, breaking and entering, and espionage against malevolent forces. One thing he would not do is go after the mob. And it was for the reason that he feared that one of his agents would be corrupted or bribed or bought off by a member of La Cosa Nostra, the mafia. And this would tarnish and embarrass the FBI. So he wouldn't go after didn't recognize La Cosa Nostra as a force. He would not go after corruption in Congress, although this was an original intent back in the days of the FBI's foundation, again for fear that scandal would taint the FBI. And fatally, in the last year of his life, he would not follow the president's orders, President Nixon's orders, to bug and wiretap and break into the homes of friends and families of the far-left anti-war movement. This he would not do for fear of getting caught and embarrassed. Well, what did Nixon do? You know as well as I.
He developed his own methods of doing that.
He set up his own little bucket shop, didn't he?
And it led fairly directly to the efforts of Mark Felt, who took over after J. Edgar Hoover and who became Deep Throat, a fascinating part of American life, and sort
well,
of
more
got
importantly,
back at
yeah. More importantly, Hoover said no to Nixon. Mm. Nixon set up his own team of ex-FBI agents and ex-CIA agents, and they called them the Plumbers.
Mm-hmm.
And they were caught breaking in to the Watergate Hotel 6 weeks after J. Edgar Hoover died.
Mm-hmm.
Had Hoover lived, never would have happened.
The famous E. Howard Hunt.
Right. And this led directly to the downfall of Richard Nixon and almost to the downfall of the FBI itself. Hoover's number two man had been, as you correctly noted, a fellow named Mark Felt, whom we now know better as Deep Throat, who was the source of almost all the news breaks that came to light about the fact that the president had violated the law, obstructed justice, conspired to violate the civil rights of Americans, and lied about it, and had it all on tape. Now, Felt, in a just world, would have been named to succeed Hoover, but Nixon knew perfectly well that Felt was Deep Throat.
Hmm.
And this is all caught on tape. Hmm. One of the most fun things about this book is that Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon taped their conversations with Hoover. And anybody can hear these by going onto the websites of the presidential libraries, the Nixon Library and the LBJ Library. And the conversations are just mind-boggling.
In fact, wiretapping played a major role in Hoover's efforts for decades, and then, in a sense, he was wiretapped himself.
Hoist by his own petard, Monroe.
What are some examples? You got one of the presidential conversation with or about Hoover that you find tasty?
Sure. I mean, he was sitting around drinking with President Nixon and telling a lot of stories about how he tried to screw and subvert President Kennedy and his brother Bobby, who was the Attorney General and, in theory, Hoover's boss.
Mm-hmm.
And he said of one particular incident, Hoover says to Nixon, "And that's how I got in bad with Bobby." And Nixon says, "In bed with him?" And Hoover said, "No, in bad with him, bad with Bobby." Much hilarity ensued.
Yes, in fact. The president with whom he got along least well, and you've touched on this, was Harry Truman. In fact, you write that the minute Hoover was told that FDR had died, and this relative unknown Harry Truman had become president, Hoover's first thing that he did was to send for the FBI file on Truman to find out everything he could about him.
That's right. They didn't get along, and Harry Truman was convinced, and he said several times, and he wrote later in life, that the FBI under Hoover had become an American Gestapo, his words.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Hoover didn't like that, and he knew that's what President Truman thought, and so he went after the Truman administration by inferring that it was riddled with communists. Now, there were a couple of communists, communist spies working for the Soviet intelligence service. But even the FBI had been penetrated by them. It wasn't some vast conspiracy of liberal Democrats in cahoots with Joe Stalin. But that's the picture he painted.
And yet all along, Truman is still enjoying the dirt, the gossipy stuff that Hoover will provide him.
This was the way that Hoover ingratiated himself with president after president, even if, like Harry Truman and like Jack Kennedy, they found him and his institution despicable or distasteful. Political gossip, no president can resist that. The skinny on what's happening, which member of Congress is dirty or corrupt, because this information is power. And secret information is power squared. And secret information that you and only you can deliver to the president, well, that is power cubed.
All through your book, you mention the tension between Hoover and his FBI, which we think of as a domestic surveillance agency, and various attempts from the OSS to the CIA on the part of the government to create an international spy agency. He didn't want that. He wanted all that for himself, right? And constantly fought.
Yeah, after World War II, when the United States is the only superpower left standing, really, after World War II, the government of the United States thought it needed a foreign intelligence service. Well, Hoover wanted to run that. Hoover wanted to control that, and he was mightily perturbed when the CIA was created. And so immediately he started spying on the CIA. And the rivalry between the FBI and the CIA went on for decades after Hoover's death. And in fact, their ability, their failure to cooperate, their inability to play well together, was one of the proximate causes of the success of the 9/11 attacks. They would not share information. They would not cooperate. The FBI had an Al-Qaeda desk headed by a guy who hated the fellow who ran the CIA's Al-Qaeda desk. Hmm. And they were at war with one another and not united against our common enemy.
At war in sort of the same way that the Army and the Navy have always fought for resources over time? Is that?
Yeah, but this isn't a football game.
Yeah.
This is a matter of life and death.
Yeah. And how did they go about attacking each other? Just digging up dirt?
No. By refusing to accept each other's worldview, by petty rivalries over who had the better intelligence when actually their intelligence was equally poor on the subject of international jihad, and just failing to, you know, share information. If these guys don't play well together, if they don't cooperate, you get a Pearl Harbor. You get, and you know, 9/11 was our second Pearl Harbor, and we are very lucky today that the fellow who runs the FBI and who has run it, he took office, God help him, on the 4th of September 2001, is a guy named Bob Mueller, who has devoted himself for the last 12 years to getting this right. And as you'll notice, we haven't been hit again.
It's amazing. There are movies, Oliver Stone's come to mind, in which vast government conspiracies are plotted. But for so many years, it turns out the FBI and the CIA weren't very good at getting much done. I don't know how they could have been these vast conspiracies.
Well, the reality is stranger than anything that Oliver Stone can invent, I assure you. One of the joys of writing this history of the FBI for me is that like a history of the CIA I wrote a couple of years ago called Legacy of Ashes, there's enough declassified material out now so you can put it all on the record. There are no anonymous sources in this book. There are no anonymous quotes. It's all fact, and it's all backed up with documentation. And it is stranger than fiction.
Who could
invent J. Edgar Hoover?
This was more than a Google search for you. You must have spent a lot of time poring through files.
Yeah, it's been years and years of work.
Wow. And if it's like other researches, it is stuff that a lot of the stuff is irrelevant or uninteresting before you come upon a pearl, right?
No, I find that this kind of work it's just telling a story that happens to be true, and it is remarkably rewarding. And thank God we live in a democracy that is still sufficiently open that material does get declassified. Now, it can take years, but you couldn't write a book like this in England or Japan or Germany or any other democracies. Only really in America do you have a society that's open enough, with all its troubles and with all the excessive secrecy that we know characterizes government, that you can write a book like this.
Wow. We'll be back after the break to talk more with Tim Weiner about J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, and the hunt for enemies of all kinds. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Munro Dodd. The FBI under J. Edgar Hoover grew into a force unto itself in American life. A new book, Enemies, A History of the FBI, tells the story of the agency's secret intelligence operations. Its author, Tim Weiner, will be at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library on Wednesday, February 27th. That'll take place at 6:30 p.m. Right now, Tim joins us from NPR Studios in New York. And you can join us by calling us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or by emailing us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Tim, one of the rumors that has surrounded Hoover for a long time has been that he was homosexual. The reason that rumor has had such resonance, I think, is that he went after homosexuals in government himself. What about that irony?
You can trace these rumors back to their beginning, almost to the exact day. Hoover started going after homosexuals in government in 1937. And that's when the rumors started, in 1937 and 1938. And the fact is that he and the FBI, for the next 25, 30 years, destroyed the lives and the careers of thousands of people on suspicion of homosexuality in and out of government. And that is the salient fact. There's no evidence whatsoever that J. Edgar Hoover ever loved anyone in his life. Or ever enjoyed the physical act of love with anyone. And, you know, the FBI was his life. It was his wife. It was his be-all and end-all. And people hated Hoover, but he was a very skillful hater as well. And he had an almost unbelievable amount of power to make you or break you. And no one will ever have that kind of power in American government for that long, ever again.
The reason, at least the supposed reason he went out after homosexuals was that if they were in sensitive posts in governments in those days, it would have been easy to compromise them by a foreign power. Is that correct?
Yeah, and, you know, we're still now talking about gays in the military, you know, whether homosexuals have equal rights under law. The idea was, yeah, it would be a national security threat. You could be blackmailed. Well, you can also be blackmailed for heterosexual behavior, of course, and destroyed. The most recent head of the CIA, General David Petraeus, left office because he was conducting an extramarital affair. And, you know, it was just a built-in bias in our system, and it's almost gone now. It's almost eradicated.
In fact, in the early 1950s, Hoover prepared a report on Adlai Stevenson's sexual leanings, which he fed to members of Congress, right?
Oh, yeah, and to the press, sure, that the Democratic candidate for president, former Governor Adlai Stevenson of Illinois, was a drag queen. And complete nonsense, absolutely scurrilous. Mm-hmm. The man had a very active heterosexual life.
But it's certainly an example of how Hoover would dish dirt to whoever he thought could help him.
Yeah, because, again, this goes back to the power of information. Intelligence is just a billion-dollar word for information. Mm-hmm. Hoover had the power to dig up information on pretty much anybody in this country using both legal and illegal means, using all the techniques of espionage. And the very idea that he was like this superpower who had files on everyone and knew when you were sleeping and knows when you're awake, it magnified his power. The fear of the man magnified his power under law.
Hmm. Kansas City, what role do you think government ought to take in policing and surveying their citizens? Call us at 816-235-2888. And now we have on the telephone Thomas from Gladstone. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning. I wanted the caller, first of all, the caller said was very, very poignant, but I was hoping the caller could justify Hoover's attempts to destroy blacks and women during the pre-World War II and post-World War II, and justify Truman's comments that he made about Hoover's organization, the FBI, being part of the being an American Gestapo, since after World War II, a lot of the Abwehr actually went to work for the FBI. So I wanted him to maybe talk a little bit about that, and I'll take his comments offline.
Thank you.
Very, very interesting and complicated question. Hoover was a racist. He was a hater. And the things and the people he hated all his life. He hated black people. He hated Jews. And he hated liberals. The most despicable form that this hatred took was the continuing attempt in the early 1960s by the FBI to destroy Martin Luther King. Hoover bugged Martin Luther King's homes and offices and the hotel rooms where he stayed. And he did so on the authorization of the Attorney General of the United States, Bobby Kennedy. And picked up tapes of Martin Luther King having sex with a woman who was not his wife. And Hoover tried to peddle these sex tapes all over Washington. He didn't get any takers in the press or in the government. Times have changed. It was too filthy, it was too dirty for anybody to pick up on. Hmm. No one would touch that stuff. So what did he do? One of his top agents mailed a copy of these sex tapes and a poison pen letter advising Dr. King to kill himself to his home, and his wife opened it. Now, that's about as low as you can get.
Yep. It's amazing. That's just amazing. And so the reputation he developed was, in large part, apparently deserved. He kept
in those days, I have to say, in those days, he ruled by fear.
Yeah.
In the 50s and 60s. On the other hand, when Lyndon Johnson, President Johnson, ordered Hoover to destroy the Ku Klux Klan, well, Hoover didn't want to do that. He thought the problem in the civil rights movement wasn't the segregationists, it was the integrationists, as he put it. But President Johnson ordered him to do this, and by God, he did. Mm. He used all the techniques that he had, bugging, wiretapping, blackmailing, breaking and entering, and in 3 years, the Klan was pretty much crushed.
Amazing. Let's go now to Howard in Overland Park. Howard, good morning.
Hello, everyone. J. Edgar Hoover called Emma Goldman the most dangerous woman in America. And by the way, Emma Goldman sort of has a Kansas City connection because she spent 2 years in the penitentiary down here in Jeff City. But love her or hate her, she was a remarkable woman. My question is, do you have any stories about J. Edgar Hoover going after Emma Goldman? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, and if you you can read them in Enemies. Emma Goldman, people who don't know her name, was an anarchist, a proponent of free love, and in Hoover's eyes, the embodiment of the Red Threat to America in the months and years after World War I. And he fought and won to have her deported. And he saw her off at the dock when her ship, with a lot of other deportees who were thrown out of this country on Hoover's demand because they were Russians and because they had spoken out against the government of the United States. They hadn't blown anybody up. Their words were what hung them, their ideas and their words. And Emma Goldman and several hundred of like-minded souls were put on a ship and sent to Russia. in December 1920, and Hoover saw her off at the docks of New York. And Emma Goldman wrote that they had a conversation. Hoover said to her, "Well, I've treated you fair and square, haven't I, Ms. Goldman?" And she said, "About as fair and square as I suppose you could." And there's a very beautiful chapter in her memoirs about being cast off on the ship and sailing past the Statue of Liberty and leaving New York bound for the frozen wastes of Russia in December 1920. So, yeah, they met.
Mm. For years, Hoover kept what he called a security index of Americans. This was a long list of Americans who had what he thought was subversive tendencies. Tell us a little bit about that security index, and also it leads to a great story about its most massive failure in the case of an assassination.
Yeah. Well, at its height, the security index had the names of close to 25,000 people who were deemed threats to the United States and its leaders, and who should be jailed forthwith without trial or warrant in the event of an international crisis or at a time of high political tension in the Cold War. Well, one guy who didn't make this list was a fellow who had deserted from the Marines, defected to Russia, lived there for 3 years, come back to the United States, and was a known violent person with far-left political beliefs. And this is the man that shot President Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald. He wasn't on the security list, even though he'd been back in the United States for a long time and had, in fact, barged into the FBI's office in Dallas to tell them to back off surveying his wife, who was a Russian woman, and who had gone down to the Soviet embassy in Mexico City 6 weeks before the assassination. The FBI had a file on that. They just never looked at it. And they never put him on the security index as a dangerous person. The person who had to unravel all this after Hoover died was the former police chief of Kansas City, Clarence Kelly, who became the head of the FBI after Hoover's death in the 70s, and he had a terrible time with it. Just the dealing with the horror of explaining what Hoover had done as it came out in dribs and drabs. He had a terrible time of it and finally had to resign. He was a very good police chief in Kansas City, but he wasn't competent to run the FBI after Hoover's death.
Because Hoover had been going after this person, that person, the other person, famously so, and yet, famously, in the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, it just the agency just missed it. It's mystifying to me.
What the skeletons that came tumbling out of the closet after Nixon's fall and after the Watergate hearings, of what both the FBI and the CIA had done in presidents' names, invoking presidential authority, would really tarnish the name of every president going back to FDR. Illegal orders to commit illegal acts, and even under in the Eisenhower and Kennedy administration, assassinations, plots against foreign leaders ginned up by the CIA. And it was very hard for us as a nation to cope with this because the FBI and the CIA weren't rogue elephants. What they did when they broke the laws of God and man and the United States, they had by and large done on the orders of presidents. And it was very hard for us as a people, as a democracy, to cope with that fact that presidents going back to FDR had ordered the FBI and the CIA to do illegal and immoral things. And Clarence Kelly, God bless him, had to deal with that, and he couldn't.
Hmm. And perhaps no one could for years and years, except you'd say the current director, Robert Mueller, is doing so.
It has really only been in the last few years where the FBI has begun to come out from under Hoover's shadow. Now, do they still do things that offend the civil liberties, sensibilities of Americans? Yes. Do they confess error when they get caught? They do. They didn't used to do that. And what you have now is an FBI director, Bob Mueller, who has served longer than anybody since Hoover. And he knows perfectly well and has said, the FBI director Mueller has said, that he's not going to be the guy who, when he retires, they hang a medal around his neck and say, congratulations, you won the war on terror, but we lost our civil liberties.
Hmm. You're listening to Central Standard Friday. I'm on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. We're here today with Tim Weiner, author of Enemies, the Story of the FBI. And I must, for full disclosure, I've got to admit that I knew Tim from his days on the Kansas City Times. And was it the 1980s, Tim?
It was in the early 1980s, and the biggest thing that happened in Kansas City during those days was the collapse of the Hyatt Hotel on July 17th, 1981, in which 114 people lost their lives. Mm-hmm. And the Kansas City Star and the Kansas City Times found out why and how this could happen in a brand new hotel. And that was quite a story.
The box beams. If you'd like to call Tim Weiner, talk about the FBI, ask some questions about J. Edgar Hoover, talk about the role of government and policing and surveying its citizens, call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Tim, going back a second to JFK, Hoover had some real problems with him, too, and it had to do as much with his lifestyle as anything. Is that right?
Well, President Kennedy knew that J. Edgar Hoover had a tape and a transcript of events during a very pleasurable weekend that young John Kennedy had spent in 1942 with a woman named Ingra Arvad, who was suspected of being a Nazi spy.
Wow.
And they had enjoyed a carnal knowledge of one another. She was married. He was not at the time. He was a very young man. Hoover let Jack Kennedy's father, Ambassador Kennedy, know about this. This was hanging over JFK's head the whole time he was in the Senate and in the White House. Neither the president nor his brother Bobby, the attorney general, could control Hoover or get him to change his ways.
And he dies in 1972, right as we mentioned,
correct.
Right as Nixon and his White House are starting to part from him, and that was, of course, in the days of the SDS, which became the Weathermen, which became the Weather Underground, and the Weather Underground and these groups had, in fact, been fairly successful in carrying off bombings and terrorist activities in the country in the early 1970s.
That's right, and the FBI never solved any one of the various 38 bombings that they did. They were very good. They could, you know, sneak a bomb into the Pentagon and have call the FBI and say it's going to go off in 5 minutes. And it went off in 5 minutes. They put a bomb in the Capitol, in the Senate washroom. Ever since Hoover died, and ever since there was a reckoning for the violations of law in the pursuit of national security, we have been trying to come to grips with this as a nation. We want to have security and liberty. We want to be safe and free. But national security and civil liberties are opposing forces, okay? Yet we can't have one without the other. We don't want to lose our civil liberties in the name of national security, and we don't want to be hit again with a third Pearl Harbor. God knows. Mm-hmm. So this balancing act between security and liberty, between wanting to be safe and wanting to be free. The FBI has to do that every day. They don't want to be caught violating American civil rights, nor do they want to be caught snoozing in the face of a terrorist attack. Calibrating this, getting this right, is very hard, but we are honor-bound as Americans to demand both from our intelligence services and from our military.
That they at least try.
And it's really only been in the last few years that I think they've been getting it right most of the time.
Let's go now to a caller, Steve in Leaf Summit. Good morning, Steve.
Yeah, hi. You touched earlier upon he had devastated the Communist Party overseas or hampered it. Could you give a little bit more detail how he was able to do that? And if, you know whether he was an admirer of Sidney Reilly or knew Sidney Reilly?
No, I don't think he was. He wasn't a very widely read man, but he knew a great deal about communism, both the Communist Party of the United States and international communism. And he hamstrung the efforts of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union to infiltrate the United States by destroying the Communist Party of the United States, which had been used as a cover for Soviet espionage for many years. The communist brand didn't sit very well here anyway. But by the 1950s, the Communist Party of the United States was a spent force. Hoover then went after the leaders of the civil rights and anti-war movements in the 1960s by stoking the fears of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon that these red-blooded, homegrown Americans who opposed the war or who fought for civil rights were tools of the Communist Party of the United States.
Steve, thank you for your call. Let's go now to David in Lawrence. Good morning, David.
Good morning. And so do you want me to hear what I have to say, or do you have a question?
You are on the air with Tim Weiner.
Okay, well, 1970, I received a visit from an FBI agent. I had just returned from taking some Polish students to the Grand Canyon, just on a lark. They said they hadn't seen it, and I said, well, let's just go. Anyway, I came back, interviewed by the FBI agent about these students and their involvement with the party, which I didn't know about. And then I sent away my FBI file, found out they had two or three pages, although most of it was blacked out. So anyway, I can get my FBI file. Seems like things ought to be declassified by now.
What year did this happen?
This is 1970.
Yeah, you ought to be able to get it. You really
yeah.
ought to.
It might have been, actually,
now,
might
you
have been
have
73,
to be...
but anyway, but I have actually asked for it again, and I didn't get any reply, so I don't know what to do.
Well, you have to be very patient. But if you properly fill out a Freedom of Information Act request, they will honor it. But it won't be next week or next month, I guarantee you that.
Yeah. Well, okay, I know there are several hundred people who were investigated by the FBI, and I know I was because I was visited by one. And oddly enough, the agent didn't check to see who was in the house, so my roommate was in there listening to me being interrogated, which I thought was pretty funny because it didn't seem very secure. But anyway, that's just the way it is.
All right. Well, David,
okay, well, thanks.
It's a heck of a story, David. Thank you very much. Let's go on now to Dan in Kansas City. Good morning, Dan.
Hi. I used to do quite a bit of expert testimony work on behalf of federal courts as a friend of the court, and I quit doing it in part because I noticed that the FBI seemed to just juggle facts and ignore the law and just do whatever they wanted to do, in fact, and I couldn't be a party to that anymore. My question is, from a legal standpoint, I'm now hearing we have an agency that acts essentially as renegades for the administrative branch. It has no charter, no constitutional basis, no congressional mandate. Has no one ever challenged? I mean, I can't just go out and start throwing wiretaps and arresting people and showing up in court and testifying just because I say I'm a good American. I have to have a legal basis for that. Has anyone ever challenged the fact that these people don't legally exist?
Yeah, you want to differentiate between the history of the FBI in the 20th century and the way things are now. Warrantless wiretapping is not done, although you can get a secret warrant if you're the FBI or any one of the 17 other U.S. intelligence agencies that work in the name of national security. Warrantless wiretapping is outlawed by the Constitution, although it was done in Hoover's day. You can't get away with that now. The work is very, very hard. It takes a toll on people. But the FBI has performed in the years since 9/11, I think, with a higher standard and a greater obedience to law than many of its sister agencies, notably CIA and NSA, who on orders from President George W. Bush conducted warrantless wiretaps, ran secret prisons overseas, and condoned torture.
Tim, one final question here. What makes people do the kind of work that J. Edgar Hoover and his secret intelligence agents did?
I think it is almost always patriotism. I think that it is out of a genuine attraction to secrets and to know what's going on in the dark side of life. And I think it is generally motivated by love of country. But you can also find throughout our history this constant tension between national security and civil liberties, and presidents and FBI directors, although not the present one, have been all too willing to let national security trump civil liberty. In this country, we have to have both, or we violate our birthright as Americans. And we've been trying for 236 years to get this right, and we're going to keep on trying.
Tim, thank you very much. And that's all the time we have for today's show. Our guest has been Tim Weiner, author of Enemies, A History of the FBI, published by Random House. Tim will speak at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library on Wednesday, February 27th. The program will begin at 6:30. Tim, thank you so much for this fascinating book and for joining us this morning.
You bet, Monroe. Thanks.
Our show was produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Our announcer is Kim Noble. A special thanks to NPR Studios in New York. You can listen to the program again, subscribe to our podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs on KCUR.org. Tune into Central Standard next Monday as the Cash Money Crew helps understand behavioral finance. Up to Date is next with former Nebraska Senator Ben Nelson discussing compromises in the Affordable Care Act and Chuck Hagel's Senate confirmation. This is Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd, and have a great weekend.